Hello and welcome to Camp Kaiju Monster Movie Reviews. We're your hosts, Vincent Hannum,
Matt Levine,
and we're talking about all our favorite monster movies, the good, the bad, and the downright campy, and asking if they stand the test of time. Kaiju, creature features, space invaders, the supernatural, and everything in between, all strange beasts welcome here. Camp Kaiju is sponsored by BanditsEmporium.com, where you can shop exclusive monster-inspired t-shirts with part of the proceeds supporting this show. BanditsEmporium.com. Hit the link in our bio. As they say, we sell shirts. Hey, as Camp Kaiju says, stay campy, everybody.
Our first foray into the zombie subgenre.
Yeah, indeed. It's a great movie, produced by Val Lewton for RKO Pictures in 1943. We'll get more into the cast and crew, obviously, but one of the best atmospheric horror movies of Hollywood's heyday, I would say.
Very eager to dive into this movie because it was not at all sort of what I expected, and some things I wanted to run by you, but we'll get there. For now, thank you all for listening. If you're listening to Camp Kaiju, wherever you podcast, can't thank you enough. Please go ahead and leave us a rating and review and tell a friend. It's honestly the best way to grow the show, and we appreciate all your support with that. Other news and notes?
So check out our website, campkaijumoviereviews.com. We have a list of the 31 days of kaiju, so that's one monster movie for every day in October. A lot of good stuff on there, some kind of ridiculous, gory, schlocky stuff, along with some more kind of understated classics on there as well, so... if you need some horror movie recommendations for October, check it out.
I've been sharing them like crazy on our Instagram, if you want to look there. But we're talking movies like, you know, everywhere from A Nightmare on Elm Street 2, Freddy's Revenge, to, I don't know, what's the most off-the-wall movie you could think of?
One that kind of jumps to mind for me is Messiah of Evil, which is a very underrated horror movie from 1967, I believe. Very weird, very ambiguous, kind of surreal and dreamlike. Not really like anything else I've ever seen. So that jumps out at me. The remake of The Blob is on there. The Howling by Joe Dante. A lot of other stuff.
I saw The Howling on TV last night. Oh man, I forgot how weird this movie is.
Yeah, the plot's all over the place. Like you think it's starting out one way and then it just like suddenly shifts directions. It's totally unpredictable. Super stylish, one of the best werewolf movies ever.
Yeah, honestly, would love to talk about that one day on the pod. I watched Werewolf by Night, speaking of werewolves, on Disney Plus. Everyone's talking about it. It's an adaptation of a Marvel comic book called Werewolf by Night, but it's not superhero-y, right? It's the Marvel's sort of supernatural realm, which I always like, very pulpy. It's shot in black and white. It's supposed to evoke the classic Universal horror movies. I think it's fun. I think it's a solid romp through some gothic cemeteries with some cool monsters.
That sounds great. I have to admit that Marvel stuff is maybe like my blind spot in like current pop culture stuff. I'm not very well versed in it. But that sounds like it's right up my alley. So maybe that is the one that I will finally check out and... you know, become a believer in the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
What else? Oh my gosh, big news. October 29th in Minneapolis, if you're in town or can make it even, we will be having a secret screening. It's a mystery. What will we watch? Whatever it is, it will be a free screening at the Trilon Cinema at 3 p.m. October 29th, 2022. We can't wait.
It's going to be really fun. Yeah, we're going to have a short film before the feature, and then we're going to have kind of a live recording, Q&A, kind of audience discussion afterwards, which will, you know, become a podcast episode shortly thereafter. So it's going to be great. And if you want to be part of the live podcast experience, check it out. Trilon Cinema, 3 p.m. Saturday, October 29th.
Heck yeah. I won't tell you any more than it stars one Boris Karloff, and it is from... Universal Pictures.
It's a classic.
What else? I think that's it. Cannot forget to mention our Patreon along with all this other stuff. we're just brimming with monster content here in October. Our Patreon is available. It's up and running. For as low as $5 a month, you get special access to bonus material, bonus episodes of the podcast, as well as videos and articles, just some really cool bonus features related to spooky season and beyond. So, blech, got that all out of the way. Let's talk about zombies.
Yeah, zombies.
What is your personal history with this film?
So, you know, I first found out about it because I got into the Val Lewton, Jacques Tourneur horror movies that they made. Val Lewton was a producer. Jacques Tourneur was the director. They also made the original Cat People, which we've talked about on this podcast before. Another one of my favorites for sure. You know, I just heard great things about I Walked with a Zombie, that it's very complex, a little bit like questionable or messy at times, but in pretty fascinating ways. And that always kind of tends to appeal to me a little bit. You know, if there's like a lot to kind of dig into, I always love that about a horror movie. So yeah, I watched it probably for the first time, I would say 10 years ago. Really loved it with some reservations. And like, I think this is maybe like the fifth time that I've seen it now. And every time I watch it, I feel like the messy things about it, or like the complicated things about it, are what make it so great, especially in the context of Hollywood at that time in 1943 and like other films that were kind of made around the same time. This one really kind of stands head and shoulders above similar movies. And I just think there's so much to talk about. Really fascinating movie.
I can see exactly where you're coming from with that. I was completely new to this movie, not to Jacques Tourneur or Val Lewton. I love Cat People, which you brought to the podcast last year. And I was super excited to see another movie from those, from that duo. As a whole, I have to say I am woefully unread in the zombie genre. I have seen a total of 4 zombie movies in my life. I Walk with a Zombie. White Zombie from 1932, I think. Its sequel, Revolt of the Zombies, which was a revolting hot mess of garbage that I will riff on in our bonus episode available only on Patreon, and Shaun of the Dead.
Nice. Shaun of the Dead is great. But it's funny that you bring that up, right? Because Shaun of the Dead and like the movies that is parodying, like Night of the Living Dead and the whole George Romero, Dawn of the Dead, Day of the Dead, all that, as well as like 28 Days Later and 28 Weeks Later, very different zombie movies. Like the zombies in those movies could not be more different than the, you know, very voodoo-based Haitian cultural references that we see in I Walked with a Zombie. And even a little bit in White Zombie, although it's not done as respectfully or as carefully, I would say. So yeah, just like the zombie movies that most people know of nowadays are like very different than I Walk with a Zombie.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's so I'm fascinated to dig into this genre, because just looking at it as a whole without any, you know, specific knowledge, I don't know. I want to like watch every zombie movie and just kind of trace the evolution of it.
Yeah, it's fascinating for sure. Like, I feel like the, you know, with the Romero movies and then afterwards, it kind of became, zombies became like a symbol for a lot of different things. I know we're getting ahead of ourselves a little bit, but a symbol for a lot of different things, you know, like government corruption, militarism, like consumer culture, things like that. Whereas like the original intention, that was not like the main metaphorical power at all, as we'll see as we'll kind of talk about when we discuss this movie.
Yeah. Well, on that note, why don't we just go into the plot synopsis briefly? Catch people up if it's been a while since you've seen I Walked with a Zombie. This is a great refresher. If you're new, if you don't mind spoilers, hey, stick around. Otherwise, I don't know, skip ahead a few minutes just to get to the discussion about it.
Indeed. And this movie is only like 68 minutes long, but it's still like jam packed with plot. So fair warning, it's a little complicated, but yeah. We'll be as concise as possible.
Totally. All right. Take it away.
All right. So it starts with an opening voiceover narration in which Betsy Connell, a Canadian nurse, relates that she once walked with a zombie as we see two people walking on the beach. We don't know exactly where they are or who those people are at this point. We then flash back to the beginning of the story itself. A man interviews Betsy, asking her if she believes in witchcraft, and then sends her to a job in the Caribbean on the island of Saint Sebastian. Betsy travels there by ship, meeting the brooding Paul Holland on board.
Betsy is hired to care for the wife of Paul Holland, a sugar plantation owner on Saint Sebastian, which is home to a small white community and descendants of African slaves. On the way to the plantation, the black driver tells Betsy that the Hollands brought slaves to the island and that the statue of T. Misery in their mansion's courtyard is the figurehead from a slave ship, a depiction of Saint Sebastian being pierced by arrows.
At dinner, Betsy meets Paul's half-brother Wesley Rand, who clearly resents Paul. Later that night, Betsy hears crying. When she investigates, a woman in a white robe walks towards her, her eyes vacantly staring. Betsy screams, waking everyone. The woman is Jessica Holland, Paul's wife, whom Betsy is to care for. The next morning, a white doctor named Maxwell tells Betsy that Jessica's spinal cord was damaged by a tropical fever, leaving her without the willpower to do anything for herself.
So, on her day off, Betsy encounters Wesley in town. While he drinks himself into a stupor, a calypso singer tells a tale about how Jessica was going to run away with Wesley, but Paul would not let them go. She was then struck down by the illness. Betsy meets Mrs. Rand, Paul and Wesley's mother, who is a doctor and a Christian missionary. That night at dinner, Wesley accuses Paul of being responsible for Jessica's condition. Later, Paul, with whom Betsy has fallen in love, apologizes to her for bringing her to the island and admits that he may have been the cause of his wife's condition. Betsy determines to make him happy by curing Jessica.
Betsy gets Paul to agree to try a potentially fatal insulin shock treatment on Jessica, but it has no effect. Their black housemaid, Alma, then tells her that a Hungan, or a voodoo priest, cured a woman of a similar condition. Betsy takes Jessica without permission through cane fields past a crossroads guarded by a native named Carrefour to the home fort, a place where voodoo worshippers gather. There they watch a man wield a saber during a ritual. People are given advice by a voodoo priest, whom Betsy is shocked to find is Mrs. Rand. The latter explains that she uses voodoo to convince the natives to accept conventional medical practices and tells Betsy that Jessica is incurable. Outside, the locals stab Jessica in the arm with the sword as a test. When she does not bleed, they are convinced she is a zombie. With Mrs. Rand's help, Betsy takes Jessica home. Paul is furious, but also moved by Betsy's attempts to cure Jessica. The local authorities investigate the next day, and the natives demand that Jessica be returned to them for further rituals. Later, Carrefour approaches the residence, and Mrs. Rand orders him to leave. Paul insists that Betsy return to Canada, worried that he's going to demean and abuse her as he did Jessica, especially as he realizes he is also falling in love with Betsy. She reluctantly agrees to return home.
The next day, Dr. Maxwell reports that the situation has sparked an inquiry into Jessica's illness. Mrs. Rand claims that Jessica is a zombie. Although she had never taken voodoo seriously before, Mrs. Rand reveals that when she discovered that Jessica was planning to run away with Wesley and break up their family, Mrs. Rand felt herself possessed by a voodoo god. She then put a curse on Jessica. The others dismiss her story, but Wesley becomes obsessed with freeing Jessica.
Using an effigy of Jessica, a voodoo practitioner attempts to draw her to the home fort from afar. Paul and Betsy stop her the first time, but Wesley allows Jessica to leave the second time. Wesley then pulls an arrow out of the statue of T. Misery and follows her. As the voodoo dancer stabs the doll with a pin, Wesley thrusts the arrow into Jessica, killing her. He then carries her body into the sea. Later, the natives discover the bodies of Jessica and Wesley floating in the surf.
I walk with a zombie, y'all. So that effigy you mentioned, that was, for all intents and purposes, a voodoo doll?
Correct. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. That's a more accurate way to say it than effigy, probably.
Right. But it doesn't, and you know, it doesn't treat the voodoo doll the way I think modern expectations of a voodoo doll are.
Right. Well, you know, I'm sure we'll talk about this later, but there's a constant question of, like, you know, what the voodoo practices are actually doing. Because, like, even though the voodoo practitioner, is stabbing the voodoo doll with a pin. At the same time, the white man Wesley is stabbing Jessica with an arrow. So, you know, what's really to blame for her death? Probably, like, being stabbed with an arrow, you know?
Yeah, there's a nice supernatural-ness to that. Like we said before, the film was produced by Val Lewton. He made a number of atmospheric, low-budget horror movies for RKO Studios, including Cat People, The Seventh Victim, and The Leopard Man. I Walk with a Zombie was directed by Jacques Tourneur, who directed Cat People for Lewton, as well as other classics like Out of the Past. I'm unfamiliar with Out of the Past, and I want to ask you, did Jacques Tourneur direct The Leopard Man and or The Seventh Victim as well?
He, I believe, I'm 90% sure, directed The Leopard Man. I might need to check on that. He did not direct The Seventh Victim. That was Mark Robson, who actually was the editor on this movie. He would go on to become a director. Out of the Past is great. It's not a horror movie, but it is a great film noir with Robert Mitchum. One of my favorite film noirs. Highly recommended movie. So the screenplay was written by Kurt Siodmak, who wrote many novels and screenplays, many of which were in the horror genre, as well as Ardell Ray. The film was based on an article by columnist Inez Wallace. As we'll talk about soon, that article was kind of forced upon Lewton. We'll get more into the details of what that article entailed shortly. So because he did not really want to just adapt that article, Val Lewton really wanted to adapt Jane Eyre by Charlotte Bronte. So this movie kind of became an unlikely adaptation of that novel as well. The editor was Mark Robson. Like I said, he would go on to become a director. He directed such films as The Seventh Victim, also produced by Val Lewton, which we just mentioned, and Valley of the Dolls, the kind of infamous late 60s Hollywood sleazefest movie.
Oh, sure. I've heard of that.
Yeah, it's pretty good. I mean, it's campy, but it's a lot of fun.
Interesting. Man, what a bridge. Okay, so then for the actors, we have Frances D as Betsy, our ostensible protagonist. And then we have Tom Conway, a prolific actor in the studio era. He plays Paul. You say George Sanders' brother?
Yeah, do you know George Sanders? He was in Rebecca, the Hitchcock movie. I just kind of think it's interesting because their voices are exactly the same. It's uncanny. Like a sort of like silky British accent, you know?
Dude, okay. Now it all makes sense. I was like, Tom Conway, I know the name. I swear I saw him in something recently. I looked at his filmography and I was like, nope, I've never seen any other film with Tom Conway in it. But it was George Sanders in Rebecca who I was thinking about.
Yeah, totally. Like, they do sound exactly alike. And their acting styles are pretty similar, I think, too. This is kind of another tangent, but I read recently that they both wanted to be actors. And when they were starting off, they were, like, trying to decide who would, like, keep their actual family name, which was Sanders. So George Sanders won that, obviously. I think it might have just been, like, a coin toss or something. So then, you know, his brother, Tom, soon to be Conway, just, like, opened up the phone book and, like, pointed at a random name, which was Conway. And that decided his actor name for his entire career.
Well, I think Tom Conway is a, for me, it's a, maybe a more debonair stage name.
Yeah.
Than George Sanders.
It definitely fits, yeah.
So, Teresa Harris plays the maid, Alma. And Matt, you provided a really interesting quote. Do you mind if I read it?
Please do.
Okay. So, in 1937, 6 years before this film came out, she said, quote, "I never had the chance to rise above the role of maid in Hollywood movies. My color was against me any way you look at it. The fact that I was not, quote, hot, stamped me either as uppity or relegated me to the eternal role of stooge or servant. My ambition is to be an actress. Hollywood has no parts for me."
Yeah, but, you know, it's a fascinating quote. And I think, you know, sadly, there are so many examples of that. Hattie McDaniel, who won an Oscar for playing a similar role in Gone with the Wind, is maybe the most famous example. So yeah, it's unfortunate. And, you know, again, of course, Teresa Harris is playing a maid in this movie, and I Walk with a Zombie. So it's at the same time, I think that what this movie does with the maid character is kind of pretty interesting. Like, I think that she is kind of like gives voice to the experience of a lot of the slaves or descendants from slaves that are still on this island. So I just think that this quote is sort of, it kind of encapsulates the sad duality of this movie, because it is guilty of some exoticism, and it's not, you know, it is kind of hard to watch at times. But at the same time, I think it's trying to comment on that experience, the kind of haunting legacy of slavery in the case of the movie, or racism in the case of this quote that she has. And, you know, I think that's one of the most fascinating things about the film. So anyway, I know that's kind of a tangent, but I think that quote's really interesting.
I noticed her in the film. I was like, oh, you have screen presence. You know what you're doing. And so Sir Lancelot, he plays the Calypso singer. His full name is Lancelot Victor Edward Pinard. I also thought about him as, again, another face, a diverse face. And he had parts in numerous Luton productions and helped popularize Calypso in North America. That's a cool bit of trivia for you. And yeah, I think his presence in the film simultaneously offers some charming levity and portends an undercurrent of eeriness that really hits home with the Betsy character.
Yeah, for sure. And I think it's interesting that, like, we kind of first find out about this, like, family's sordid history through this character, like, the whole subplot of, or not really the subplot, but, like, kind of the main plot of the movie, that, like, Jessica fell in love with her husband's half-brother and was going to run away with him. Like, we find out about that first through this Calypso singer, and I just think that's kind of an interesting way to give this seemingly small character a lot of authorial agency in sort of, like, delivering that plot line.
Yeah. Right. Okay. Before we get into some cool history about zombies and then production history about the film itself, we got to plug BandsEmporium.com, people. They are our official t-shirt partner. You can get monster-inspired t-shirts for your spooky season attire at BandsEmporium.com. Links in our bios, Instagram, podcasts, wherever. There's a link there for you. Or you can visit BandsEmporium.com. When you buy a t-shirt, a portion of the sales goes to support Matt and I and the Camp Kaiju podcast. So lots of ways to support us. This is just one of them if you want a cool t-shirt out of it. So BanditsEmporium.com, as they say, we sell shirts. As Camp Kaiju says, we love walking with zombies.
It's also the name of our first hit single, We Love Walking with Zombies. Stay tuned for that.
Do you also instantly think of the song Walk Like an Egyptian?
This title? I actually thought of the song Walking on Sunshine, but both of them make sense, yeah.
Before that, we get into the history of the film, I just wanted to share some history about Haitian voodoo, because this film is still very much in bed with the catatonic version of the zombie, rooted in voodoo religion and spiritualism. And in these movies from the 30s and 40s, the zombie is more or less just a shell of a human being. When I say catatonic, really, they're walking and they're standing and they're doing manual labor, but they're not doing anything else. There's nothing behind their eyes. They do not speak. And they're really at the whim and mercy of whoever is in control of them. So they are servants, and that's how it ties into the history of slavery, how it becomes an allegory for slavery. There's Haitian voodoo, which comes from West African spiritual traditions that came over in the slave trade. And then over time, you had all these different Africans from all parts of the continent mingling, and their religions were mingling, and then that evolved into this fascinating hybrid of spiritualism called voodoo. Over time, not that voodoo became voodoo, they are separate, distinct traditions, actually, but, you know, over time, Haitians migrated to the United States, and you have the Creole, Louisiana Bayou tradition, which kind of became more of the voodoo. For our purposes, they're more or less interchangeable, but I just wanted to make a distinction that they are technically different. And in both traditions, They believe that the human body is controlled by two spirits. One spirit that controls personality and consciousness, and there's one spirit that controls motor functions and the physicalness. When a human dies, it takes a few days for the spirit to pass on. And in these days, the body is vulnerable. The spirit, these two spirits are vulnerable to being taken over. And this could happen by like a spiritual voodoo priest with ill intent. And they can conjure a spell that takes over the motor functions and the personality. That is the zombie, essentially.
I just think it's fascinating. I did some research for this conversation, obviously, but I love to hear you talk about it. So
we had that tradition, and then how does this relate to Hollywood? How does this come into the popular culture then? Well, in 1915, the United States occupied Haiti. A lot of political, economic, colonialism there. But the fact was there were U.S. troops stationed in Haiti. 1915, then these troops came home and they brought home to the United States all these stories about voodoo and zombies. And it was then, 17 years later, the first feature-length film starring a zombie was released, White Zombie with Bela Lugosi. But I find it fascinating that it was U.S. troops coming from abroad, coming from this exotic place. And they were like, oh, there's these tales of undead people and wicked spiritualism, and it's not Christian. And then, like, it just kind of snowballed into this sensational picture of this unknown foreign thing called voodoo.
Yeah, that seems to happen so often in the history of movies that, like, as soon as something is, like, exoticized and vilified, then, like, Hollywood takes it up as, like, the big scare tactic of the moment or whatever, And usually, of course, it's done in, like, very offensive, blunt, kind of racist ways. And I think that's more true of White Zombie than I Walked with a Zombie, but there are some scenes that, like, do give into that sort of, like, lurid exoticism a little bit in I Walked with a Zombie. But how it does that is pretty interesting, I think.
Hollywood loves to just, well, not just Hollywood, but books. I mean, the tradition of storytelling, we boil things down into tropes and shorthand. Hmm. So it's like, oh, you have people dancing around naked, not naked, but scantily clothed in a ritual. You think of something not Christian. You think of something sordid and wicked. One other thing I want to touch on is the idea of voodoo dolls. I was curious. I Googled voodoo dolls. Not a thing. Apparently, voodoo dolls are 100% or 99% Hollywood fabrication.
Yeah, I mean, that's not surprising. there are some parts of the Home for Rituals in I Walked with a Zombie that are carefully researched. There is an actual Haitian folk song that is featured in the film that was used in voodoo rituals. But in some ways, like you said, Hollywood fabrication, and the voodoo doll is probably the best example of that.
Because I've never, I don't know, have you ever seen a voodoo doll used for good?
I can't say I have. But I've all, in real life, I've never seen a voodoo doll used for evil either. So I guess that's...
Well, that's true. Well, at least in movies. Yeah. So voodoo priests, like modern day practitioners of a legitimate religion, they're like, wow, thanks Hollywood. Like, you have associated this seemingly always negative thing of harm and death with our religion. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Right. No, that's a good point. And, you could definitely say in I Walked with a Zombie, well, I think actually it's made very clear that the white family is kind of the source of evil and violence and trauma and malevolence on this island. And the voodoo practitioners, it's their religion, it's their spiritual culture. And when we see these rituals in the movie, like, in many cases, they are trying to cure somebody or help somebody. So, it is exoticized, but at the same time, it's not really made to seem evil in this film,
True, but then I felt like the white characters were afraid of this.
Yeah.
Thing they didn't understand.
That's very true. I think it's, to me, it's partially intentional because those, you know, the white family of the Hollands, their ancestors brought slaves to this island in the first place. And they have a long history of exploiting African peoples, people of color, the natives on the island currently in the time of the film. So, you know, I think the film is kind of providing an intentional critique of how white colonizers and slave owners, habitually exploit and oppress and abuse people of color without trying to understand them. It does that intentionally, but I also think that some of the, I think there is still supposed to be like a visceral impact of like, ooh, this is like creepy and sordid and we don't understand what this is. And that's kind of like the tension of the movie, you know?
Yeah, that's the tension of the film, and I think it's the tension of watching it, because I think it's a very fine line. I struggled with this where I was watching it, being like, oh, this is just a movie about white fear and protecting the white woman against these black people. Mm. But then, you know, thinking about it and hearing what you have to say and other critics, and I'm like, oh, yeah, they are scared of the black people. But really, they're scared of their own guilt and compatibility in the slave trade, and they can't face their own guilt about that.
Yeah, that's absolutely how I read it. But I think both of those things are true, and that's I always like watching movies where, you know, it can kind of hold like two contrary ways of thinking simultaneously. I just think that's fascinating, you know.
It makes for great conversation, even if it makes my head hurt a little bit.
No, I hear you. Yeah. I still don't know exactly how to feel about this movie or how to like succinctly explain that, you know?
Yeah. In terms of production backstory and release.
Yeah, sure. So Val Lewton was kind of forced or pressured by RKO executives to adapt the Titler article, which was written by Inez Wallace and published in American Weekly magazine. That article was about Wallace's purported meeting with zombies, not the living dead, but with people she had encountered working on a plantation in Haiti. So these workers in Haiti, their vocal cords and their cognitive abilities had been impaired by drug use, which rendered them obedient servants who understood and followed simple orders. So in this case, the practice of voodoo was used by essentially slave masters or slave owners to, you know, make their workers work harder, essentially. And that's actually in White Zombie, too. Bela Lugosi's character does that as well. So Lewton did not really like this article very much, but he was kind of required to use the title and adapt it in some way. So like we already talked about, he kind of like combined that with Jane Eyre, and that's kind of how we got the weird combination of I Walked with a Zombie. So like pretty much all of the RKO Val Lewton movies, they were shot on a shoestring budget in less than a month. In fact, it was stipulated that all of his productions would cost less than $150,000, and all of them would come in under 75 minutes. So that was like a stipulation in his contract, and as we see in movies like this and Cat People, he's still able to do so much. He and his directors and the cast and crew, they're able to do so much with kind of a limited production circumstance, you know?
Mm.
So I Walked with a Zombie was premiered in Cleveland in April 1943. Initial reception was very mixed. A lot of critics said it was just sordid shock value. Even the positive reviews kind of just said it was solid horror, very atmospheric, but did not really dig in too much for the most part into the kind of more complex themes that are at its heart.
Yeah, which is why I think it's interesting. And I do think that the anti-slavery and prejudice themes are there, but I think it took, you know, 70 odd years for those to come to the forefront. I'm not surprised those themes were absolutely lost on critics and audiences in 1943.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm also not surprised that we in the 21st century can catch those. And I always like it when a work of art, it takes time for it to sort of be appreciated for its themes.
Right. Yeah. You mentioned before, you talked about like the history of the U.S. Occupation of Haiti in 1915. An interesting trivia fact about this movie is that it was supposed to be made very clear that Saint Sebastian was an American colony. There were supposed to be American flags, and there was supposed to be a backstory about the Holland sort of American ancestry. And then, like, kind of the censorship code, the Breen code, the production code, I guess is the official way to say it, made them cut all of those references out of the film. So if that had been included, I feel like that sort of anti-slavery, anti-colonialism comment would have been way more explicit.
Interesting. Yeah. And you know what? This was made during the height of World War II. So the code was, yeah, like, no, we are not showing anything anti-American at this point.
Right. Yeah. You know, I mean, like, that kind of, yeah, reveals, like, the critical impulse of the film, I think, a little bit.
Well, we know the filmmakers behind this movie were very smart people. You know, this was not schlock they were turning out. It's just when censors get involved, when studios get involved, you can sometimes lose sight of the original intention.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Well, can I talk about the figurehead of T. Misery a little bit?
Yeah, fascinating. And honestly, ghoulish imagery with that statue.
Yeah, and to me, that's an extremely powerful symbol of how the legacy of slavery still, you know, possesses or haunts this island. And, you know, as long as, you know, families like the Hollands live there along with the descendants of slaves, that tension represented by the figurehead will always exist, you know? I feel like, to me, this is a movie about how that extremely destructive, violent legacy maybe not destroys, it's a harsh word, but it kind of infects everybody. And that's certainly true of the black characters, but also true of the white characters. And you talked about their kind of like guilt, you know, their inability to sort of like reckon with the complicity of what they've done. And I feel like there is self-loathing among all of them. And I'm talking about the white characters specifically now. Mm-hmm. That's especially true of the character of Paul, who insists all the time, like, you see beauty here, but there's just death everywhere. And he even sort of insists that Betsy go back to Canada because he is just positive that he is going to be cruel to her. Like, he knows that their relationship is going to devolve into abuse and cruelty and violence. So, you know, I just think, you know, the romantic melodrama parts are admittedly not like the most compelling parts of the movie. But I think like even that is a reflection of the pervasive kind of self-loathing and guilt that these characters feel.
It's not a happy film. Everyone's sort of, you know, feeling their way through these haunted legacies. And the image of Team Misery is so haunting. It is only topped by the image of Kara Four, the main zombie, I guess. Now, he is a guardian. He's a... I don't know, like, how would you describe it? He's just like a henchman in a way as well, doing the bidding of these malicious actors. But his makeup is incredible. His eyes are this glazed, glassy abyss. And his black face, his black skin is ashen on his face. And he's very tall and sinewy, but there's power. Truly, whenever he's on screen, it is an arresting moment.
There are some more recent critics who suggest that Kara Four and T. Misery are intended to conjure imagery of lynchings of black people in the United States. I feel like pretty easy to see with T. Misery. That's just such an expression of black pain that it's hard not to make that association, especially for audiences in 1943. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, if this movie wanted to comment on the violence that African Americans experienced at the time the film's making, doing so indirectly probably is like the only way that they could have done so, for the exact reasons that you were just talking about. Like, the censorship restraints would not have allowed a movie to be like explicitly critical of the United States at that time. So I think it's a really compelling reading. I think that, you know, it's maybe harder to see in the character of Kara Four, but that critic, Alexander Nemirov is his name, is talking about that character's kind of stillness and their simultaneous strength and victimization. That's a really compelling interpretation, I think.
I agree with that. That's when I read that and I got on board with this critical review, you know, post 1943. And I was like, oh, I can see that, especially the character of Carrefour. Yes, you can't help but associate his misery and strength with the haunted history of slavery in North America.
Yeah, they're like the symbols and the characters are so loaded with historical context. You can read so much into them.
Because like in White Zombie or in other zombie stories with the Haitian voodoo background, yeah, like it's all an allegory for servitude and slavery and mindlessness and white domination. But I Walk With a Zombie differs from White Zombie because I Walk With a Zombie makes its imagery a pointed critique rather than just playing into the tropes and the misery, I guess.
I think another kind of contrast along those lines is that in White Zombie, the Bela Lugosi character, we never really learn like his backstory. Like he is a white character, seemingly of European descent, who's on this island, who has kind of co-opted these voodoo practices, you know, but we don't know why and we don't know where that comes from. But in I Walked With a Zombie, the character of Mrs. Rand, who is the matriarch of the family, she's a doctor, she's a Christian missionary, but we find out that she is the voodoo priest. When Betsy and Jessica go to the home fort, they discover this. Mrs. Rand is kind of the priest who is dispensing advice and kind of leading these rituals. And it's made very clear that she has co-opted these rituals in order to sort of make the native population do things that she wants them to. And certainly part of that is, she says, for their own good, so they can like take medicine, like use sanitary water, things that will actually help them out. But at the same time, the fact that like this white Christian doctor woman is the voodoo priest, like that is such a clear and like very pointed condemnation of like white people in power co-opting cultures that don't belong to them. Like that's one of the most radical twists in this movie, I think.
See, and I'm buying that. I'm not buying that. But then when I was watching it, I was like, oh, it's just another white lady dominating black people. So like the symbolism, I agree, is there, but upon initial viewing, it flew over my head.
Totally, yeah. And I think that way, that reaction is valid too, because you're right that like the representation, that's what we see. A white woman in power and the native characters, the characters of color, are kind of secondary in the film. So that is, you know, that is a flaw, that is questionable, and it's kind of hard to watch at some points. But, you know, again, I think both of those things are true, and it's hard to kind of grapple with in your mind, you know?
No, I'm with you. It's a fascinating think piece. And yeah. I'd love to read any critical essays about this film if you have any to recommend, because yeah, I really want to hear what other people say about this film.
For sure. There's one that I would recommend. There's an essay about I Walked With a Zombie written for Senses of Cinema. Martha P. Nochimson is the author, and it goes pretty far in depth into like these, you know, conceptual kind of tensions that are in the film in a really fascinating way. So that is one essay that I would definitely recommend.
Cool. And for you listening out there, we'll put that into the show notes as well, just to kind of give you all a reference.
We talked about the character of Alma before, played by Teresa Harris, and the kind of tension of her playing that maid character, even though she felt very unfairly treated by Hollywood, that she had to do that all the time. But the character of Alma has a sequence of dialogue that I think is extremely powerful. So at one point she's talking to Betsy, and Alma the maid says, "That's where our people come from, the misery and pain of slavery. For generations they found life a burden. That's why they weep when a child is born and make merry at a burial." It's a relatively short sequence of dialogue, but I think first of all it's important in that it does give Alma a voice, a very powerful voice, and kind of speaking for her people. It's unfortunate that she's one of the few characters that does speak for her people, but I still think that's very powerful. And I also think that making that clear does set up the dichotomy between the White Holland family and the black characters that are on the island. Like, it's there's no way you can miss the theme that, you know, the pain and suffering extends beyond this white family. Everybody's victimized by it. So I love that dialogue. Just wanted to read that real quick.
No, that's great. And I do thank you for reminding me of that scene, because it was a standout scene of insight into the history there.
But I think like the aesthetic of this movie is very careful. It's very precise. And I think that there are many times when the themes of the movie are presented like purely through visual form or through the soundtrack of the film. One example that I want to bring up is the very first time that we hear the character of Jessica crying, which is Betsy's first night on the plantation. The moment when we first hear her crying, it cuts to a shot of T. Misery, that figurehead that's in the courtyard of the estate. And it's a strange cut. You don't really know why we're seeing that when we're hearing somebody cry off screen. But I think that's such a perfect way to correlate the pain that's felt on this island, in this case felt by Jessica, but like it goes beyond her, obviously, to, again, this legacy of slavery. We already talked about that theme, but I think that this is like one of the most powerful and effective formal ways that the movie does that.
There was certainly a lot of imagery, I think, that carried the horror of the movie, a lot of atmosphere. I mean, this is in my good category later on. Just like the camera would linger on shots of really scary, frightening things, of skulls and, you know, even just Carrefour's face. And there's the wind through the sugar cane and the full moon. Yeah, it's pretty eerie.
Yeah, definitely. Like amazing shadowy cinematography by J. Roy Hunt. The scene in which Jessica and Betsy are like going through the sugarcane fields, and like we suddenly see Carrefour's silhouette before we even understand who it is. Really, really jarring, effective moment.
Yeah, and when Carrefour is shuffling through the halls of the house that one night,
we just have like the sound effects of the footsteps, and that's extremely effective to only hear that sound.
Yeah. Just no jump scares in I Walk with a Zombie.
Yeah, for better or worse. Yeah.
Right. I was a little spoiled by Cat People, I'm not gonna lie. I think that's maybe a more taut thriller, and I Walk with a Zombie is a bit more of a think piece. It makes you sit with its themes a little bit more.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. Yeah, I think it also is brings up the themes of the movie. Like towards the beginning, when Paul and Betsy are on the ship, there are some black sailors who are kind of singing amongst themselves. It's a very solemn song. It's kind of like a sea shanty type thing. We kind of get this sense of like this subculture or this community that's on the ship, and we don't really know a lot about them, but they're kind of, they have like a camaraderie among them, you know? And the song that they're singing, I think, like, could not be more different than the chanting that's in White Zombie, which is just like, ooh, creepy, and like, that's all it is. But it's a lot more pointed. It's a lot more, it's trying to suggest their characters, I think, and I Walked with a Zombie, even though they're not characters that will ever appear in the film again. And a similar thing, I think, happens towards the end of I Walked with a Zombie, during a pretty ambiguous ending, when we hear another solemn song that seems to be kind of like a spiritual, you know, it's very much about pain and suffering and kind of like persevering through that. And I think, again, like that the soundtrack and like the specific use of those songs is a way to suggest racial themes in the movie that are not always explicitly voiced through like the story or the dialogue, you know?
Yeah, you can get away with a lot more with song.
Yeah, so it kind of had to be subversive. And I feel like this movie's kind of trying to do a similar thing. Like you said, I could talk about this movie for hours, but I'll leave it there. There's just so much to it.
Okay, well, in that case, I'm ready to move on to our good, the bad, and the campy, if you are.
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay, for the good, I mean, I really did find a lot of good, a lot of things I liked in this film. I found the voodoo doll sequence towards the end with Jessica being lured to the home for particularly captivating, and I was just like, oh, I want to see where this goes. I loved some of the shots that Tornare lingers on, like I said, you know, the T. Misery statue. Carafor's face. I love the calypso guitar player, adding that charm, that levity. And I do appreciate what the film is saying, both on the surface. You know, it is frightening both on the surface with its makeup and direction and performances, but it is also frightening subtextually with its themes of slavery, lynching, and lost souls.
I love that, like, summation. That's perfect. Yeah. Well said. And I totally agree with that. Extremely eerie atmosphere. Very strong performances, I think. I watched this right after White Zombie. So to see a movie with good performances was a nice change of pace, you know? But yeah, for me, like, there's a lot to love. But, like, for me, it's, like, just how fascinating this movie is. Like, every time I watch it, there's more to pick apart. There's more to kind of, like, grapple with and, like, go back and forth about in my head, you know? And I just cannot resist movies that are that complicated that just, like, stay with you for long after you watch them.
Yeah, hey, that's well said on your end, too. What I didn't like so much about this movie, and this is just the dual nature that we keep coming back to in this conversation, is that, like, yes, the metaphors are there, and I understand them, but at times the film is just too, it dabbles too much in the native exoticism of the Haitian population. And I'm like, it's hard to look past some of these tropes and stereotypes. And again, exoticism. The love triangle between Betsy and the bros was just, like, Betsy started off really strong. She had this journey. Okay, I'm going to follow her. And then by the end, I feel like she just got lost in this competitiveness between the brothers. And I just missed Betsy's independence from the beginning of the movie to the end.
No, again, that's extremely well put. And I agree with all that. I wish that he didn't try to, like, sort of insert this, like, adaptation of Jane Eyre into this film, because, like, it doesn't really work very well. It's not gracefully done. You're totally right that the character of Betsy becomes a little bit, you know, she lacks agency towards the end of the film a little bit, you know? And that's disappointing considering how her character starts off. And yeah, like, I wish more of the native population, the native characters had, a presence, like, dialogue, like, we knew more about them. We talked about the calypso singer and Alma the maid, and there we do see kind of a birth, and we sort of, like, witness the character kind of, you know, greeting this baby and being pretty excited about it. So it's cool to see that stuff, but, like, I definitely wish there was more of that. And, yeah, I think context is important. I think for its time, the movie was kind of doing a lot. But, like, to modernize, it does not always seem sufficient.
That's well put.
Why, thank you.
For the downright campy, there were a couple. I laughed once. Betsy was at this, like, beach bar, essentially, ordering a drink. And she's like, oh, it's alcoholic or something. And then there's another scene later on where she is also really into whatever alcoholic beverage is being served. And I was like, oh, Betsy, the Canadian from the snow, she's on island time right now and just wants to soak it up.
I love that reading of her character. That's great. She's there to have fun.
Because then she's like, in the beginning with, was it Paul? She's on the boat going to the island. And she's like, oh, it's all so beautiful. And Paul's like, oh, you naive Canadian. Like, the island is full of death. But she's, like, really into it.
Yeah. And then, you know, that happens when she's being driven to the plantation, too. When, you know, she has a black driver who is taking her there. And she's like, oh, this place is so beautiful. And the driver's like, if you say so, miss. Which is, like, another very brief moment that's like, right, whatever you say, lady.
Yeah. Yeah, I enjoyed those moments of her character.
I think the campy moment for me is actually during the opening credits. Usually in the credits, we see the standby thing that says, like, any similarities to any people living or dead is purely coincidental. But I noticed that in the opening credits of this movie, it says any similarity to persons living, dead, or possessed is purely coincidental. Which, I don't know why they put that in the opening credits. Like, it does not really suit the tone of the rest of the movie, but they were getting their sense of humor out of the way early, I guess.
That's very campy.
It's a blink and you miss a moment. It's fun.
Yeah, very wink wink from the creators. Well, I'm ready to give this a rating if you are.
Sure. First of all, we have, it is a timeless classic. It definitely stands the test of time. Then we have, there may be some antiquated moments, but overall it's great and stands the test of time. Number three, it may be historically significant or just fun, but it does not stand the test of time. And lastly, it is not worth revisiting and definitely does not stand the test of time.
You brought this to the podcast, and I feel like I had a slightly different take with it. Yeah. However, I will say that there are some antiquated moments, but overall, I do think it stands the test of time if you approach it with the right lens and you have Matt Levine as your guide through this film.
Wow, I'm honored. Nobody's ever said that to me before. Well, thank you. That's really good to hear. Yeah, I know. Yeah, it's not always an easy watch. There are flaws for sure and things that don't date very well. For me, this is a timeless classic. It does stand the test of time. I think both because of and despite those tensions and those difficulties that we've, you know, been talking about so much. It's just such a fascinating movie to me. And it's hard to say like which I prefer better between this and Cat People, because I think they're both fantastic. You said it before very well. I think Cat People is the more fun movie, the more suspenseful movie. But I think this is the more complex and radical movie in a lot of ways.
I think it was just ahead of its time, which I didn't see it in 1943. So, you know, that doesn't matter, I guess. But I do think it is more suited to to 2022, when our society is having complex conversations around race and our history of slavery in ways that mirror the efforts of Tournaire and Val Lewton in I Walked with a Zombie. So now we are able to be appreciative of this film because it just echoes the same embattled conversations we are having in our own heads with other people in our community. And it is not an easy conversation, just as this is not an easy watch.
Historical context is a must to bring to this movie.
Well, thanks everybody for hanging out. We are going to record now some bonus content for Patreon people, subscribers, about White Zombie. And before we do that, for November, we have a very special announcement. We will be partnering with a podcast I personally love. It's called Gaze Do the D. They are all about Disney parks and Disney news and Disney movies. And it's a delightful podcast for all Disney fans. We are partnering with them with like a special crossover event. It's like a Marvel movie. And we're going to be talking Disney movies. Their hosts are going to be on Camp Kaiju. Matt and I are going to be on Gaze Do the D. And I'm going to leave you in suspense with what films we're going to cover. But yeah, just thought maybe for November, you know, it's Thanksgiving. We're thinking about families. Let's go to the House of Mouse for our family monster content.
I can't wait. It's about time we have a crossover event.
Yeah. We're at that point in the show's run now where we can... We could extend the universe.
Yeah.
Let's talk White Zombie.
Yeah.
And thank you all for hanging out. If you liked what you heard, please tell a friend, leave a rating and review, and visit CampKaijuMovieReviews.com, Instagram, or even Patreon for more monster movie content. Links in our bio. We can't thank you enough. Camp Kaiju is recorded with your help in the Twin Cities with music by Terrence Jackson. Oh, and before I forget, Camp Kaiju is sponsored by BanditsEmporium.com, where you can shop exclusive monster-inspired t-shirts with part of those proceeds supporting this show. BanditsEmporium.com. Find the link in our bio. As they say, we sell shirts. And again, as Camp Kaiju says, thank you, friends. And until next time, stay campy.
Easy enough to read the thoughts of a newcomer. Everything seems beautiful because you don't understand. Those flying fish, they're not leaping for joy. They're jumping in terror. Bigger fish want to eat them. That luminous water, it takes its gleam from millions of tiny dead bodies, the glitter of putrescence. There's no beauty here, only death and decay.
You can't really believe that.